Welcome, everyone, to a special two-part episode of the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. I'm Brian Toporek, and joining me, as always, is Morten Jensen. How are you, Morten?
I'm good, Brian. How about you, man?
I am still reeling from Stephen Curry last night.
You know what? It's so fitting that he went supernova because right now it's 86 here in Denmark, and it's been scorching all day.
Somehow
his heat just came off to us. So thanks, Steph. It's been a wonderful day.
Stephen Curry is responsible for global warming. You've heard it here first.
Don't give Trump any more ammo.
God.
We're going to build a wall around Stephen Curry, and he's going to pay for it.
Oh, boy. Let's pray that's not the case. Our third co-host today, Sarah Chalea, could not join us. She says she's at work, but let's be honest, she is still contemplating life after Kevin Durant murdered her Spurs in Game 4.
Oh, I feel sorry for her.
Yeah, so we will recap all of the playoff action since last time. We'll talk a lot about the Spurs Thunder. We will briefly touch upon Heat Raptors, although, let's be honest, no one wants to talk about that series. And we will give our autopsy for the Atlanta Hawks, who have since left us since our last podcast. But we have to first start with Stephen Curry, who made his return last night. We're recording this on a Tuesday, so he returned in Game 4. Came off the bench, looked a little rusty at first, missed his first 10 three-pointers, which he had never done before. But because he is Stephen Curry, he naturally heated up, ended the game with 40 points, scored 17 in overtime alone, which is the most points a player has ever scored in overtime in a playoff game. Morten, was that the Blazers' last chance to make this a series?
Yeah. I mean, listen, regarding the Blazers, right, people are looking at them as this, this team that have no chance whatsoever since Steph is back, or generally not have a chance because they won against a depleted Los Angeles Clippers team. I disagree. I think they gave Golden State a pretty big fight last night, even with Steph struggling. I mean, I know Steph was struggling, and that's not always going to be the case, but I'm sitting here thinking that Portland overall have just leaped several years in their evolution. Like, we thought they would be this rebuilding franchise who were going to collect assets for 2 to 3, maybe even 4 years, and then try to get back into the game. Well, they just leapfrogged that entire process, and they have become legitimate free agent players, as far as I'm concerned. So, I mean, it was their last shot, I think. But you know what? I'm not counting them out.
Yeah.
I mean, they are going to give Golden State everything they can handle. And I appreciate that, because that forces Golden State to step up their game, and they are going to need it when they meet San Antonio or Oklahoma City in the conference finals.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, the Blazers still lost Game 2, and Curry didn't play that game, but it's worth noting they were up 11 points heading into the fourth quarter. Like, as you said, they've been giving the Warriors more of a fight than I think anyone really expected. Even without Curry, we figure the Warriors would be a little worse. But Curry came back. He had 40 points, and it still needed overtime for the Warriors to escape from Portland with the victory. So I'm just as impressed as you, and I'm on the same boat. Like, I think Portland has just cemented itself as a free agent destination, especially, Damian Lillard is phenomenal. And I think there were questions heading into the year about how he would fare as the true franchise superstar without LaMarcus Aldridge. He's answered those questions resoundingly. He's had back-to-back games of 30 points. I think he had 10 assists in both games 3 and 4 as well. So he's capable of carrying a team. Like, whoever goes there doesn't necessarily need to be the number one option. Dame can be that guy. They can have, some complimentary stars around him, including CJ McCollum. I think the thing that I'm most impressed with about Game 4, aside from Steph just murdering everyone, is Draymond Green had 21 points, 9 rebounds, 7 blocks, 5 assists, and 4 steals, and no one is talking about him today.
That one elusive steal, though.
Yeah.
He would have had the 5.5 line, or the 5 times 5 line. Like, oh. You know what? We need someone out there to roll back the tape and just go searching for Draymond's 5th steal. I want to see him somehow get credit for that.
Yeah, we could just have a rogue scorekeeper add an extra one in there. take away one from Clay or from Andrew Bogut. They don't need him.
So I'm actually just gonna go back to one of your points regarding Damian Lillard.
Yeah.
I agree completely with what you're saying, but I just need to note one thing. Mm-hmm. He had two very horrible misses last night in the overtime that were forced shots that he just jacked up. Mm-hmm. Had no rhythm whatsoever. I hate those shots. Those were the two desperation shots that he took that kind of discouraged me a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because that's not really his game. He's usually pretty calm or under pressure. But last night, for the first time, it seemed like ever, he really felt it. He felt everything on his back. And to the extent of that, I'm kind of concerned that he doesn't have the necessary firepower alongside him. Like, okay, mm-hmm. he has CJ, who can also create a little bit.
Right.
But I think he needs to have, like, a sixth man who can also create, as well as a big man who can draw in a double or at least facilitate something from the inside. Because he is forced to take a lot of shots, especially from downtown, and he has to take them off the dribble. And it's such a hassle, really. And it's not really... Yeah, it is his game to some extent, but when the game is on the line and you have to take, like, a pull-up from the corner and you have to, like, tiptoe around the line, it's not optimal scenarios, you know?
Right. I totally agree. I think that's probably their biggest need this offseason is to add that third creator, someone who can play alongside Dame and CJ in crunch time lineups. You know, that Brian Roberts played 4 minutes last night. Like, that's not going to cut it. And
no.
I like Gerald Henderson, but I believe he is a free agent this summer. He's not that type of ball handler creator. You know, he can do it occasionally, but you're not going to rely on him as your primary ball handler creator, that's for sure. So,
and Alan Crabb, he can shoot and he can score, but he's not like a creator.
Right. Yeah, he's more of a catch and shoot threat for sure.
Yeah, but okay, so I'm at least going to open the door for Crabb. Because he's young. Like, what is he, 23? 22, 23?
Yeah, it's his third season, I believe.
Yeah. All right, maybe even 24. Still some potential left. He could get some ball handling down.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Well, luckily, the Sixers are going to steal him away this summer, so Portland doesn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you've been on the Crab wagon for a while.
Oh, forever. Yeah, I'm all aboard. Yeah, I think you also touched upon... I'm actually writing a piece right now for bballbreakdown.com about Dwight Howard's next landing spots.
Don't say it, Brian. No, no.
I like him in Portland.
No, you don't.
I really like him in Portland. Why? I do.
Don't ruin Lillard.
No.
How dare you, Brian?
He would be so good. He needs to be in a place where he can work in a spread pick and roll attack. He would be so good with Lillard as the ball handler, him as the center, and three shooters spotting up on the wings, including McCollum. Say that Crabb, for whatever reason, decides he doesn't want to come to the Sixers and stays in Portland. You have McCollum, Crabb, and then, like, Aminu as your four. That's a scary team. That's a really scary team. I like what Mason Plumlee has showed this year, and I don't think the Blazers are totally screwed if they have him as their starting center next year. But that strikes me as an area in which they could upgrade, and I really think Howard could thrive in that role.
I don't know. I would probably try to find, like, a stretch four instead.
Okay. Yeah.
And then live with Plumlee. Or maybe even a four who can create a little bit. Mm-hmm. I know that's not something that grows on trees, but if you can at least find maybe even a three that you can put in as the four. I'd rather spend my money on not raw talent, but a clever talent and a guy who might be a little bit younger.
Yeah,
that's really the concern I have with Dwight. I get what you're saying, but man, Dwight just has so much baggage, first of all.
Yeah.
He's going to be 31 this year.
Right.
And it just seems like he's deteriorating a little bit, mm-hmm. and he's becoming weirder and weirder in some regards. But that, fair enough, that may be due to James Harden, so I'm not going to like ignore the James Harden effect. Yeah, okay. I promise I've upgraded to hell no to at least I'll think about it.
Oh, good. Okay. That's all I'm asking for.
But the price has to be right.
Yeah, exactly.
Paying Dwight like $25 million? No. I mean,
right.
That should be a non-starter. And I get that the cap is going up, and in the grand scheme of things, it's going to be a fair contract, blah, blah, blah. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's the problem with him anywhere, really, because he's eligible for the Supermax deal, where he can get close to $175 million on a five-year deal, or almost $130 million on a four-year deal, and starts at around $30 million. I agree, that's too much. I think it's got to be a reasonable price. But if he's willing to take a slight discount, or, you know, maybe another team's offering a little bit more, and he's willing to go to Portland for the chance to win, I just think what they've showed against the Warriors is that they are not far off from being a Western Conference power, which, you know, in theory, at Dwight's age, he's probably, you know, he's made plenty of money. I'm guessing his priority is trying to find a place to win, you know, going up against the Warriors, Spurs, and Thunder for the next couple of years isn't necessarily the best idea. But if he's going to go to a Western Conference team, you know, I would prefer him to go to Portland over, say, Dallas.
I'm surprised you didn't mention Al Horford, though.
Yeah, Al Horford's another one who, I mean, yeah, he would be really good there.
Yeah, I don't think he'll go there at all. Right. I think he has a lot of other options. I think he said he loved Atlanta, so I think he's going to stick around the Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Boston would be a superior choice. But if he was keen on maybe looking at a young team like Portland, that would make sense, especially because he's, like, this perfect plug-and-play player in the new era, right? I mean,
yeah.
you can basically be any team and you could play Al Horford, no problem.
Yeah.
So, but in regards to Dwight, I mean, yeah, some other team is going to probably overpay him. There is, like, this one team on the East Coast that's been talking about acquiring basketball players. What is that team? You know, the team led by Brian Colangelo, where his father said something about, you know, we need basketball players, really with an emphasis on basketball and experience. And, you know, as you know, I just seem to be reminded that Dwight has a lot of experience. He's made the finals. He's a three-time defensive player of the year. You know, the resume is there, which is like what the Colangelos look at. So
that's true.
What is that team, Brian?
Luckily, we already have about 16 centers, so even if they wanted to sign him, don't think that's on the table. Your point
doesn't
about,
matter.
Your point about Horford is legit, though. He's also a good target for them to consider. So we'll, you know, I don't want to bury the Blazers yet. They're down 3-1 in the series. They could, I mean, they're probably not going to come back, but it's at least on the table that they could. But I think they're one to watch out for this summer, especially because they're not far away from what they've shown against the Dubs here.
Oh, they're really good. And I think more teams are going to do it Portland style.
Yeah.
Gather a whole bunch of young guys who are looked at as failures to some extent, and then give them playing time and just invite these players in and tell them, we don't care what the media said. We don't care what your previous team has said. We're just going to let you play and see how it goes, which is what they did, and it worked. So, I mean, all right, Al Farouq Aminu, like, he signed for, like, what was it, $30 million over 5 years? Or
I think it was 4 years, $30 million, I believe.
Oh, it was, yeah, okay. That's excellent, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that is so excellent. But he would, I mean, that kind of salary right now looks ridiculous because he, you know, played the way he did. When he was signed, people were like, you know, fair deal, maybe. Someone even called him overpaid.
Yeah, sure.
not me. Let's just, I never, yeah, okay, I called him overpaid.
There was some
definite, I'll own up to that.
Yeah, definite eyebrow raising when that deal and the Ed Davis deal, he was 3 years, $20 million, I believe. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about Portland GM Neil Olshey a little bit later when we touch on the executive of the year voting. But yeah, I agree. I think what Portland did last year was smart, and they're reaping the rewards right now. So we'll keep an eye on that series. I want to move over to the other Western Conference battle that we've got going on. Spurs Thunder is now knotted at 2 games apiece, thanks to one Kevin Durant, who reminded us all that he is extremely good at basketball. He went off for 17 points in the fourth quarter of Game 4, single-handedly outscoring the Spurs 17-16 for the 111-97 victory. So now they are headed back to San Antonio for Game 5 Tuesday night, knotted at 2 games apiece. I mean, where do we even start here?
We start with a question, Brian.
Okay.
since you live in Chicago, I am going to assume that you have had a gun put to your head before, right?
Thankfully, no, but knock on wood.
All right, but right now I'm pointing a gun to your head and I'm asking you.
Yeah.
Kawhi or Kevin Durant? Who's the better player right now?
Right now? Wow, that's tough. Ugh. Sorry, Sarah. And sorry, Jesse, but I'm taking KD.
You have to think about it, though.
Yeah, you definitely do. And which we'll touch on this later. Leonard was second in the MVP voting this year, so voters did not share that opinion. KD was fifth. I just think KD is not a bad defender by any means. He's actually pretty decent on that end. And his ability to create offense by himself and his ability to, like, he has the gravity based on his, I mean, before Steph Curry, he was the guy who could, like, pull up from 26 feet at any point. So he sucks defenders out, which really opens things up for his teammates. So I think, you know, Kawhi is amazing in his own right. He's a two-time defensive player of the year. He really showed some offensive improvement this year, but he's still not the type of go-to scorer who you're, you know, in a tie game with 15 seconds left, you're not just giving him the ball and saying, all right, go get a bucket.
Go get him.
Yeah, win me the game right now. Now, you can question whether that type of offense is good. You know, maybe it's fine that he's not that type of player because he's on the Spurs and they rely on movement to open up looks. So maybe he can just pass it to Danny Green for an open shot, and that's fine. But sometimes you just need guys who can hit absurd contested jumpers in close games, which is what KD did in the waning moments of Game 4. He put the Thunder on his back. Like, if it wasn't for him, the Thunder would be down 3-1 going to San Antonio. Like, that could have been Kevin Durant's last game in OKC. So I'm taking KD, but what about you, Morton?
You know what? I'm actually pretty torn. Personally, I'm probably leaning a little bit to KD, but I'm a sucker for defense.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But my point about this is when you have a series like that, or this one, and you actually have those two guys going up against one another, you just know that the product is going to be excellent.
Yeah. It's this. I mean, the rest of the playoffs have been pretty disappointing, all things considered. But this series.
Oh, you're so kind. It's been shit, right? Yeah, it's been shit.
Yeah, so this series has been the icing on that sandwich. Like, it's at least we've gotten one good series throughout the first two rounds. Hopefully, I said Spurs in seven before the series just because I wanted seven games. I honestly have no dog in this fight. I don't care who wins. I just want it to go seven games based on what we've seen. I think the thing I want to ask you about is, so Russell Westbrook in game three goes 10 of 31. After the game, he says, I took too many shots. I can't do that again. And it seemed like he was a lot more restrained in game four. He still took 18 shots, only hit 5 of them, had 14 points, 15 assists. Do you think the Thunder can win two of the next three games if Russ is taking this backseat approach, or if he's not the kind of reckless bulldozer that he usually is?
Well, you have to remember, I'm the guy that suggested that OKC traded for Chris Paul, because that's really what I think that team needs. And that's not to say Russell Westbrook is a bad player, because I don't feel that way. Sorry, Nick, but that's not that's not the case. I love Russell Westbrook, but I just don't think he's the right player to put alongside Kevin Durant long term.
Yeah,
I think he is a guy that is able to, on his own team, average, you know what, I'm actually going to go real large here, Kobe numbers back in 06, like 35 points a game.
That if he sounds has right. His own team. Yeah, I mean, because, like, James why not? Harden was doing 30 in Houston.
Yeah.
Or close to 30.
And I could totally see Westbrook going up with that number. So,
yeah.
But I think it's so hard for him to balance his level of aggression and then sort of implement KD. At times he finds a groove and then he just shoots like 7 straight possessions, and that's fine when the ball goes in, but even when it does, you still have KD outside the three waving, not getting the ball, and he loses his groove, And, you know, I don't believe in the hype about the true point guard, but Russ does need at times to find that balance of getting Kevin involved and himself involved. Yeah. I think he's gotten a lot better just finding the open man, like, overall.
Mm-hmm.
But he needs to seek out KD specifically at times and make sure those two play a two-man game.
Yeah.
It seems like good things happen when they each are in, like, the late 20s. It's so tough to answer, though, because you know what his mindset is. It's always, like, it's on, you know? It's always so aggressive, and KD is, like, a little laid back. So I think at the same time, even though I'm kind of, you know, criticizing Westbrook a little bit, I also feel like that yin and yang they have going on is kind of cool.
Right.
I kind of think it works. I mean, they wouldn't be giving San Antonio a fight if it didn't, so...
Yeah.
I'm not sure there is a... Well, I'm sure there's a problem, but I'm not sure it's that big of a problem.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Game 3, he has 31 points on 31 shots. KD has 26 on 18, and they lose by 4. So, you know, if you balance that out a little bit, if KD is closer to 25 and Westbrook's closer to 25, you can, based on their shooting percentages, you can realistically extrapolate that OKC probably wins that game. I think the thing that goes a little bit underrated about Westbrook is that he needs that aggressiveness, and he needs to be a threat to drive to the basket every time, because that draws defenders. Like, you can't just guard him one-on-one, especially if he is barreling full steam ahead to the basket. So you probably have someone help over, and then that's going to open up at least one, if not two, of your teammates. The thing is, his shot selection is, I mean, that's been the criticism of him forever. Like, he, you know, he had 10 three-point attempts in Game 3, and we've seen that stat circulating this year that I believe it's...
Third worst all time.
Yeah.
With guys
1,500, I think. Yeah. So, that's not ideal, especially when KD only took 5 three-point attempts on the night in Game 3. It's really, I mean, he's got that little mid-range game, and if that's falling, he's unstoppable. Yeah. But he definitely, it's a game-to-game balance with him. And it's hard to say. He only needs, you know, you can't prescribe a number of shots that Russell Westbrook is limited to. Because some games he's on. And if he's on, then you just got to let him be him. But I'm really, more so than the KD Leonard matchup in Game 5, I'm most interested to see what Westbrook looks like and which Westbrook shows up. Because if it's this even slightly hesitant Westbrook, I think San Antonio gets out of there tonight with the victory.
I would agree. Just going back to your point about Westbrook and the often criticized shot selection, I feel there's a huge double standard within the NBA community and NBA fans.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say Russ takes 20 mid-range jumpers in a game, but at least 55% of them goes down and he's hot, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's going to go on Twitter afterwards, oh, he took good shots.
Right.
And then in the other game, if he got like 20 of the exact same shots, but he only made 5, then, oh, that's a horrible shot selection. It's so utterly ridiculous because he takes the same shots game in and game out. Sometimes they fall, sometimes they don't. I mean, sometimes he's overly aggressive, and sometimes even when he's overly aggressive, the shots go in. There's like that. I think he's very similar game to game. I don't think he's this wild card that people make him out to be. So I think a lot of that has become like the hype, like the criticism here. It's like, okay, you know, the Twitter crowd going crazy, and that feeds into other people, and then it becomes a thing, and then articles are being written, and oh, it's been a problem for years. Well, shit, you made it a problem. It might not have been a problem, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a really good point.
But I do agree that he needs to, at times, tone down and read the game. That's probably the best thing I can say. He needs to read the game. Like I mentioned this previously, like Damian last night, he didn't read the game when he took those two ill-advised threes. He was just thinking about getting up a shot.
Mm-hmm.
When Russ falls into that category, and, you know, hell, every NBA player falls into this category, even LeBron, even KD, even Kawhi Leonard at times, it happens. Then he gets scrutinized to like a perverse degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's quite insane, really, because he's, as you mentioned, he's the one just putting this tremendous level of pressure on every defense against him. I think he draws tremendous amount of fouls. He can get to the line. He can hit him, by the way.
Yeah.
And he can facilitate. He rebounds. And he gives so many transition opportunities for the Thunder overall that, yeah, I at times I call him directly underrated. I mean, that's, yeah. And then at times he's overrated.
Right, you know? Right.
It happens. He's just not as stable as other guys. But in the end, it's not like he's doing a whole bunch of things differently. It's just the nature of the game.
Yeah, to the read the game point, I think that obviously comes into a play with Durant just because he's handling the ball so much. But really, my thing is with Steven Adams, who's been, in game three, he had one shot attempt.
Yeah.
In game four, he had eight, and he's had 16 and 11.
Yeah.
You know, that's been the big advantage so far for OKC is the front court, because LaMarcus has been going nuts, although he hasn't totally cooled off, but he's not dropping 40 points a night in the last two games. But Tim Duncan, he looks old. He looks really old. And David West and Boris Diaw have not been providing much help. So it's when they've been going to Enes Kanter and Steven Adams, it's been a big advantage for OKC. So again, to your read the game point, I think Westbrook really needs to trust in his teammates that aren't named Kevin Durant. He needs to trust Ibaka, Kanter, and Adams that they've got a matchup advantage right now, and they need to exploit that, because that's, you know, you can't beat the Spurs with just two players, but if you get your bigs going, then you don't necessarily need, you know, Andre Robertson is totally useless. You're probably not getting 17 from Deion Waiters again, but if you get 30 points, 40 points from your front court, then, you know, all of a sudden KD and Westbrook have 50, 55. That's 90 to 95 points right there. So I'm very interested to see what happens tonight. I want to give a brief shout out to Tony Parker, who I thought before the series would be useless and very much.
He's not dead.
Yeah, he looks good.
He's not dead.
Yeah, game high 22, or a team high 22, I should say, on game four. On 10 of 16 shooting. He was really just abusing Westbrook in pick and rolls for a while there. So props to him for not looking like a corpse. You know, hopefully Duncan can snap out of this, but otherwise I think we need to start bracing Sarah for some possible retirement talk this summer.
Well, you know, you have to remember both Duncan and Danny Green went scoreless.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen often, especially for Danny Green, right?
That's true, right.
At least current version Danny Green. I could sort of anticipate Duncan doing it a few times because the man is 40.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
But Danny Green taking three shots, missing them all in 28 minutes, I don't see that happening once more. I see him coming out hot tonight, like hitting five triples and just stretching the court, opening everything up for Kawhi. I mean, Kawhi himself went 0-for-4 from downtown, and you know the Spurs, when they don't have the long ball going, and not that they take the long ball all that much, but it's effective when they do.
Yeah.
And they were just 2-of-12 that game. So getting just 6 points from the 3-point line for them, that's not enough.
Yeah.
So I mean, yeah, I think they're gonna do a lot better now, especially with Pop's adjustments. He's still the best adjusting coach in the league, in the history of the league, actually. I still had the Spurs, man.
I
would be surprised as hell to see Oklahoma City take this series. I really would.
Yeah, I still have the Spurs as well, but I would be surprised, but not totally shocked, because I have been at least a semi-believer in OKC all year. I still think their late game offense is going to cost them at one point, possibly tonight, but we'll see what happens. I think we need
more Boban.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they haven't gone to Boban a little bit more, given that the amount of minutes they played to Steven Adams.
Right.
I mean,
yeah. You know? I wouldn't be surprised if that's one of the adjustments we see tonight, because they've got to do something, especially if that front court gets going early.
Yeah. And, you know, even if that doesn't happen, who cares? They're going to get KD in the summer anyway, so.
Oh, please.
Oh, you know what? Let's just cross that bridge for a moment.
Yeah.
If that happens, the Spurs Golden State, you know, conference finals next year.
Oh my god.
That is not just going to be the NBA finals, that's going to be like the Olympics as well. It's going to be like the NBA finals, the Olympics, the World Championship all in one.
They need to like literally cancel the Western Conference playoffs and just do a best of 21 of that series if that happens.
Yeah.
That's completely. Yeah.
I mean, oh, if that happens, I would love to see Durant in a Spurs uniform and just being taught under Greg Popovich. That's like fantasy, you know, fanboy fantasy level crazy.
Let's not get Sarah's hopes up here. She'll, because when that doesn't happen, she's going to hate us forever.
Oh, when that doesn't happen. I hear where you're, okay.
Yeah, we'll touch on KD's free agency in a later podcast because I've got a new theory about what he's going to do, but let's reluctantly turn our attention to the East now, because we have to talk about this series briefly. Toronto Miami is now knotted at 2-2 as well. Thanks. I'm nodding off.
Yeah. You know, they're knotted at 2. I'm nodding off, man. Yeah.
Thanks to one Dwayne Wade, who has had back-to-back 30-point games, the first time in the playoffs since 2010.
That was nice, though.
Yeah. He looks like his pre-Heedle self, which is great to see, because there are a lot of people who have been on his case as, you know, being on his last legs, and he's had the knee problems the last couple of years, so it's good to see prime D-Wade back even for a couple games.
Also terrific to see that DeRozan and Kyle Lowry has remained consistent in being inconsistent. Awful. Yeah,
I think that's the big thing to take away from Game 4 is that DeRozan sat out almost all of the fourth quarter until Kyle Lowry fouled out with less than 2 minutes left. Then he came in. He did bang up his right thumb, I believe, in Game 1, and he's been wearing a wrap on his hand when he meets with reporters during shoot-arounds and practices. So I'm wondering if that's a bigger issue than we realize, or if he's really just not that good.
Yeah.
I mean, Corey Joseph was the Raptors' best guard in Game 4.
He was. Even though he wasn't like completely efficient. 14 points on 17 shots is never good, but he just seemed like to be under control.
Yeah. So that's definitely something to watch for with this series moving forward, is if Lowry and DeRozan can finally get it going. Because the big matchup advantage that Toronto had for the first couple of games was Jonas Valanciunas, but he is now out for the series with the sprained ankle. You would think Miami would be thrilled about that, but Hassan Whiteside is also out for the series with a sprained MCL. So
yay,
both starting big
injuries.
Men. Yeah, both starting big men. Probably the most intriguing part of this matchup until Dwayne Wade started going off. Both of them are out for the series. And now, I mean, that game went into overtime last night and no one was excited. And then Golden State Portland went into overtime last night and everyone was like, thank you, that we deserve this. After having to watch that overtime game, we deserve this one. So have you changed your prediction at all? I think we both had Miami in 6 before this series started. Did the JV and Whiteside injuries affect your outlook?
I think Toronto is losing a little bit more than Miami is, simply because I think Miami just can compound the issue a little bit better. They have like Dwayne Wade, who can come into the post a little bit.
Yep.
Amari can get extended run and he can score a little bit. You can put Dang at the four. Yeah, well, Dang plays the four, but in super small lineups, you can even get away with playing him at the five at times. You know, they have so many possibilities there, whereas Toronto has Bismack Biyombo, who's a wonderful defender, wonderful rebounder, and he even looked good offensively last night. I mean, he can't 5 out of 5 from the free throw line. That's encouraging for him. I don't remember seeing him go flawless on that high volume before. So,
yeah, and he had that murder dunk as well.
Yeah, I mean, so if he can build off that, that's good. But right. I don't assume that he can build off the offensive production, because I don't see him as an offensive-minded player. So I think Toronto, in that regard, loses a little bit more. No, it doesn't change my perception of the series, though. I could go 7th now, a 7-game series now, maybe. But at the end of the day, what's really important here is it's not going to get any more exciting. It's still going to be so utterly boring. Like, here's the thing. The ass that is the 2016 NBA playoffs have only squeezed out two diamonds. And that is Spurs, Thunder, and Golden State, Portland.
Yeah.
So far. I have not been excited really for any series. Boston, Atlanta was kind of okay. That was kind of okay.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it's just been horrific. It's been rough. So many blowouts. I even think there's a record going already. The more wins with a 25% margin or 25 point margin ever in the playoffs already by the second round. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah. So to answer your question, who cares?
Yeah, that's really the point. Because now, I mean, JV is out for the rest of this series. Whiteside, the Heat call him day to day, but I mean, he has a sprained MCL. Steph Curry just missed 2 weeks with one.
Yeah,
he's not coming back for the series. And if Miami advances, there's a decent chance he misses part of the next series against Cleveland too. So I think the big takeaway here is that whatever chance either of those teams had of even putting the tiniest scare into Cleveland, probably gone now. Like, I think we can safely book the Cavaliers into the finals unless LeBron James has both of his legs amputated tomorrow.
Like, do you even think Cleveland at any point feared either Miami or Toronto or anyone?
Miami, really? A little bit. Miami, Toronto, no, but I think Miami...
Because of what, though? Just because of the old LeBron-Wade factor?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, and they have the small ball lineup to challenge Cleveland. I think the dang at the four look gives Cleveland some problems. Having Whiteside come off the bench, I mean, they've been starting him in the playoffs, so maybe that changes, but having him come off the bench presented some problems. They don't have the true burly center to go up against him, since Timofey Mozgov is basically out of the rotation. Whiteside caused some problems for Tristan Thompson in particular. And Cleveland's big strength against Atlanta was on the glass. Like, they out-rebounded them by 30 in the four-game series. I think it was 54-38 on the offensive glass. So getting a second possession is really crucial and just breaks Cleveland's opponent's spirit. But having Whiteside there, you know, he's bigger than Tristan, and that's going to negate the ability to extend possessions a little bit. So, again, I picked Cleveland in the finals before the playoffs started, I think, as did just about everyone. But I do think Miami could have at least put a scare into them a little bit.
I just think that went out the window when Cleveland hit 25 threes.
Yeah,
and then just continued hitting like 21 and then 16.
Yeah, I think they shot almost 51% from 3-point range against the Hawks throughout the series. So
I mean, come on! Right now they're playing like the Golden State Warriors, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, if they keep shooting like this, they had nothing to worry about. I don't know that you can count on J.R. Smith to continue shooting like this.
Oh, you can. As soon as you just said the words count on and J.R. Smith in the same sentence,
As they learned last year, like he was really good against the Hawks in the conference finals, and then he plays the Warriors and just went ice cold. I think it was under 30% from three against them. So there's a decent chance that our boy J.R. cools off a little bit in the next series. Yeah, I mean, if they keep shooting threes like this, it's going to be... I mean, it's possible, not necessarily likely, but it's possible that Cleveland goes fo-fo-fo and sweeps all three in the East.
What would it be called if you go fo-fo-fo and then get swept in the finals? Yeah. Like fo-fo-fo, something like that?
Right, that sounds about right.
I kind of have a theory on the poor playoffs overall, Brian, when I'm looking at this series. Because we're sitting here, we just know Cleveland is going to make it, and we know like one... out of we know it's gonna be Golden State, right? Can we just call it? Sarah, but okay.
If Steph's healthy,
So it's those two, because I've been sitting here really wondering why these playoffs have been so poor, and the level of quality has swung tremendously. And it dawned on me that so many teams, even those that have been in the playoffs this year, have no freaking clue where to go in terms of where the development curve is, if they want to rebuild. Everyone, there are so many teams right now that wants to rebuild, wants to reshuffle, wants to retool. And because everyone have the same fear. We don't want to be stuck in the middle. Well, you know what? In a 30-team league, someone has to be in the middle sometimes, and everyone is avoiding it. They want to be at the mountaintop, or they want to be down in the rain, in the mud puddles. That's where they want to be, either or. And because this level of frustration for teams that don't want to be in the middle, you just see so many teams that are not really defined make the playoffs and not really knowing what to do with it when they get a little bit further. I mean, hell, I don't even think Portland knew, you know, getting to the second round. What are we doing here? We didn't even plan on this. And Miami potentially going to the Eastern Conference Finals, like, okay, but what about next year? We don't even know if Hassan Whiteside is going to return. We don't even know if Dwayne Wade is going to return if he demands a ridiculous salary. What about Luol Deng? There are so many open questions to everyone, really, that there is like this sense of teams not knowing who they are yet. And it's frightening, because what about next year?
Right. Yeah, it's a good point. It's actually a perfect transition to our Hawks, because they now have been swept by the Cavs twice in the playoffs in the last 2 years. They have Al Horford and Kent Bazemore as unrestricted free agents. I actually just wrote a piece for bballbreakdown.com about what's next for the Hawks. Aside from Horford and Bazemore, they have to figure out what's going on with the point guards. They have Dennis Schroeder, who is up for an extension this year. If they don't sign him to one, he will be a restricted free agent next summer. Jeff Teague is a free agent next summer. The Hawks don't have a single player guaranteed to be under contract past 2016-17. So to your point, they don't know what the hell they're going to be in 18 months. And they were shopping Horford, Teague, and even Kyle Korver at the trade deadline, according to ESPN.
Yeah.
But they didn't actually make a move. So, you know, I'm really curious what they do this summer. Because if you bring Horford back, you know, that's probably going to be about $145 million on a five-year deal. They could... There's a way for them to re-sign both Horford and Bazemore. They'd probably have to do Bazemore first, since they don't have his early bird rights, which means they can't exceed the cap to sign him. So they would need to get him signed first, then do Horford, because his cap hold is about $18 million, I believe. So it's smaller than what his salary would be. So they could just bring the band back. And it sounds like head coach Mike Budenholzer wants to do that. But it begs the question, like, if they do that, they're basically capped out. You know, how is that team any noticeably better than the team that just got swept twice?
Agreed. That's going to be the big question. By the way, while we're at it, during this summer, we need to like devote an entire podcast just to cap holes. Because it seems like that's an area that not everyone gets. Is that fair to say? Mm-hmm. And that's completely fine, by the way, because the CPA is complicated as hell. So no, not judging, but that's a fair point. In regards to Atlanta, I don't think they even know. I think they signed Paul and just decided, you know what, let's run with what we have and let's see. And then if they somehow were to get the same magic as last year and win like 50 games with near the All-Star break or all 40, but yeah, then they could continue their run, but they didn't. They really took a step down, understandably so. And now I think they're really considering all options. I remember the trade deadline thing. I was doing a live trade deadline show on my Danish podcast, and we were looking at like so many feeds, you wouldn't believe it. And Horford and Korver kept coming up. It wasn't just one time, two times. It was like also beat writers. I mean, they were legitimately shopping those guys. And when you do that, you either have no idea what you're going to do like 18 months from now or even half a year from now, or you are sort of in the process of saying, let's blow it up and start over. No deal was found, which is fair. And then they decided to go all in because they might as well use Al for as long as they could. I get that. Mm-hmm. But now they risk losing him for absolutely nothing as well, which is yeah, tough, honestly.
Yeah.
If they lose Al for nothing, if they lose Bazemore, where do they go? I mean, they have to trade Millsap, right?
Yeah, I think so. That was kind of the conclusion I reached, is that if those two guys leave, your best player is about to be 31, and he has a player option for 2017-18, but he's probably going to turn that down depending on what the new CBA looks like.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically your entire team is heading into a contract year. So, it in one regard, it almost forces you to give Horford whatever, however much he wants, and then you see what happens next year. I mean, I think the problem with trading Horford, and the same thing happened with Dwight Howard, is that no team wants to give up a significant number of assets for a guy who can walk in 3 months. So now you have Horford signed for 4 years, 5 years, whatever it may be. Then a team may say, all right, we get, you know, 3-4 years of Al Horford after this coming season. We'll actually give up something for that.
Yeah.
Part of the problem there is he's going to be making so much money. Do you really want to be the team that's paying him 30 plus million when he's 34?
No.
And even if you are, just the way these contracts are going to be, you know, jacked up over the next 2 years, it's going to be really hard to match salaries. Guys just aren't going to have $30+ million salaries who were signed under the previous salary cap.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a real challenge for Atlanta. I think, you know, I have a feeling they're just going to re-sign Horford. I think they have to let Bazemore walk just because I think he's going to get more money than they're willing to pony up. But that basically puts them right back where they were this past summer. You know, they re-signed Millsap, let Damari Carroll walk. Now they have a glaring hole at three again. So it's not easy for the Atlanta Hawks. And as to your point, I think it speaks to the uncertainty awaiting a lot of franchises this summer.
The Hawks are just cursed because remember the ISO Joe years?
Yeah.
That was all the talk of the town. That was the Hawks are stuck. Like they at the most, they're going to make the second round. Then they decided, you know what? You're right. We're going to make some changes. We're going to mix it up a little bit. We're going to get a new coach. We're going to get some very good veterans in. We're going to do something different. We're going to trade Joe, trade Josh, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now they find themselves right back in the middle. I will say this. It's a better version than the ISO Joe teams, though. It's,
for sure.
It's more entertaining. Sure. It's better disciplined and it's way better defense. I like watching them play. So that's a bonus. But they're still in the same goddamn place as they were 5-6 years ago.
Yep.
This is the Truman Show. Like, it goes all around, around, around. You see?
Yeah.
Round, around, around. This is like the Hawks. And it sucks because they have the potential to be so good, Bri.
Yeah.
Especially Budenholzer.
Yeah. I think it speaks to the challenges of not having a superstar to build around.
Yeah.
You can construct a 45-50 win team pretty easily, but if you don't have that true like franchise caliber guy, it really caps your ceiling. So
I have a theory on that, by the way. And this is just me. This is not like anything I've read or any. I think Jeff Teague was the guy they hoped would break out to become a superstar. They after the 2011 second round series against Chicago. That was the Derrick Rose's MVP season.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it was Mike Bibby who went down. Was it Mike?
That sounds right. Yeah, I think he. Oh god.
Yeah. So long.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jeff got some run, and he did well. Right. And he did well against the league's freaking MVP. So the Hawks decided, you know what? Next year, you're going to play. And he did, 33 minutes a game, and he started looking real good. His shot selection was awesome. He ran the team. Defense was good. I mean, he did well. And I think they really hoped that he would step into like the upper echelon of stardom.
It's interesting. Yeah.
And then when it never happened and he got stuck being stuck. He's a tremendous player. Just don't get me wrong. He's a tremendous player,
right.
But he got stuck at like the very good level, not quite, just a fringe all-star that made the all-star team. And that's
like an above average point guard, probably not top five, but like somewhere in the top 10 to 15 range.
Yeah, exactly. So when he didn't reach that, that capped their potential.
Yeah, it's a good point. So we'll keep an eye on the Hawks this summer. They got a lot of tough decisions on their hands. Well, that'll do it for our first part of our two-part podcast. Join us next time as we talk about the MVP race and the Executive of the Year balloting, both of which came out earlier this week. Until then, be sure to check out bballbreakdown.com for all of your playoff action. Got series recaps coming up, game recaps, we'll have series previews, and be sure to check out part 2 of the podcast coming out very shortly.